ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land. There are about 14,000 satellites orbiting the Earth. The traffic up there is heavy and is about to get much, much heavier. Tons of junk are also floating around up there. Satellites are colliding. How to handle traffic in space was the subject of a recent international scientific conference in Sydney. That later. We're also going behind the lines of Myanmar's civil war, where the military regime, while continuing to slaughter, is promising the first elections since they took power. We're going to have a look at that. But first, to Canberra, to talk with Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Now, Susan Lee is on the road selling net zero. How do you think she's going?
Well, she's certainly showing that she has a lot of gumption to get out there and make the case. Today she did the kind of media that would sort of make many politicians kind of curl up in the fetal position. It was just very intense. She did multiple podcasts. She did a press conference. She did 7:30 tonight. So she is throwing everything at trying to sell this policy, sell herself as the credible leader of the opposition, and message to her own party that she has a lot of energy and that they should be backing her to continue on in that job.
And she talked to you. How did you find her? What is it like to interview Susan Lee?
Look, she's generous with her time, and she's certainly, I think, in terms of the different types of personalities you come across, she holds her ground and she can be combative, but she's also, I think, keen to engage. I do find her to be the type of interviewee that listens and does genuinely attempt to answer the question in some cases. But, you know, she's very clear about when she doesn't want to engage. And she, at the moment, obviously on the question of leadership, is trying to just avoid dealing directly with the question of her own future, of the polls, of the commentary within her party, of the commentary in the sort of more general media landscape. But I think at the same time, you know, these ultimately are questions that are being asked because there is a lot of chatter about her future.
Anna, give the woman credit, for heaven's sake. I mean, it was one of the few questions she answered directly. You said to her, do you have the numbers to survive as leader of the opposition? And she said yes.
Now, well, that was on the third time.
Yeah, it was the third time. But she did say yes, unlike...
Look, yes.
You know, unlike, you know, what seats do you reckon this net zero policy will win the coalition? Now, we didn't get an answer there.
Though she did say she hoped it was all of them. So she certainly had something prepared. But I think the problem that she faces is a credibility problem. And it's one that's related to the fact that it was only, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that she was talking about the importance of reaching net zero by 2050. And you could say David Littleproud was also talking about that as well. They've now got to turn around and tell the electorate not only that, you know, now they've landed on the right policy, that net zero isn't necessary to get emissions down and to reduce power bills. But on top of that, they've got to try and sort of convince their own electorates. Like, this is not just about the parties. And I think this is where the next couple of years are going to be so crucial in what happens next. It's one thing for Susan Lee and David Littleproud to bring the Liberals and the Nationals together to come to an agreement here. It's a very different thing to convince the broader electorate in those city seats, those outer metro seats, and for the Nationals, even some of those seats in the north of New South Wales, for example, on the coast that have dealt with flooding, other natural disasters, where there is a softness in the vote at the moment, and potentially they could face real difficulties in convincing enough voters to side with them at the next election.
Just amazing. Just amazing. I'm very interested in the appearance of Christmas presents as one of the expenses that electors are facing. Now, she said that to you in the interview, and I've heard it a couple of other times today. Apparently, this is a reason for us ditching net zero, is that we face expensive Christmas presents. Are you across this argument? Can you help me there?
This just absolutely taps into what the Liberal Party in particular thinks might be the golden magic of this plan, which is if they can tap into that cost of living pressure, and if it's widespread enough, and if people do start to connect the kind of energy policies of the government and the renewables transition policies of the government with the idea that they can't afford the basics, then they think the argument might change. The biggest problem for them, though, is that every kind of credible energy expert that we speak to, economists that we also speak to try and test this idea of renewables, largely the reason that we've got higher power bills, they say that's not the reason. The reason is about the international volatility in prices, aging coal-fired power stations. You know, renewables have some small part to play, but they're not blamed by the experts for what's happening. So this is a huge problem for the Liberals and the Nationals in actually selling where they've landed.
It was another question that she declined to answer when you asked what scientists and economists are actually backing your plan. You didn't get anywhere with that question, did you?
No, I mean, this is what we deal with when we're interviewing politicians. but I do, I think this is one of the issues that they will continue to come up against. And it's one of the things that some of the moderates within the Liberal Party are very aware of, because everyone's getting live feedback from their communities as all this debate is unfolding. And one of the issues is the coherence of the policy and whether it kind of stacks up. And so a lot of people who are very busy and have big pressures in their lives and who are just kind of facing paying the bills and getting on with their jobs and their families might not have as much time to think, you know, does Tony Wood from the Grattan Institute have a position on this? But there are a lot of people that polling has shown over many years are quite engaged on the question of, you know, what happens to the planet and what's the future that we're leaving the next generation, and are fairly knowledgeable about some of these kind of critical issues that Susan Lee is getting pulled up on. So, you know, there are policy holes at the moment that she has to try and deal with.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Anna Henderson, Chief Political Correspondent with SBS. Anna, why can't we ask about commentary? Why is there a sudden new rule that political leaders won't comment on commentary? Haven't we been commenting on commentary since kind of the beginning of time?
It's a new addition to the pantheon of ways that politicians can avoid tough questions generally about their own popularity. And it's not one that's been confined to just the Liberal Party either. We hear it a lot from the government too. We hear it a lot from all politicians. The Prime Minister was very much leaning into that when he was leading up to the last election and under a lot of pressure about whether or not it was going to be, you know, a minority government. And he reminds journalists in Canberra on a regular basis of how wrong that ended up being, and how misjudged he was and underestimated he was. And we heard some of that same kind of language from Susan Lee over the last week as well, using that word underestimated about how she's being treated at the moment. And today she had a pretty tough time too when she was dealing with a radio interview with 2GB, and she was played some clips from members of the public saying they liked Andrew Hastie more than her. So there's been some tough moments for her throughout today in sort of dealing with that question of whether or not she's the right person to lead the Liberal Party. But yes, she leans into that answer of I don't deal with commentary. But sometimes she says it when it's actually facts that are being put to her. So that's also an issue. That's not necessarily a catch-all for just anything that's critical of her, but that's how she's using it at the moment.
Do you think it's the dimple? I mean, Hastie's dimple. Do you think that that gives him kind of extra weight in the community?
Well, I think there are some within the Liberal Party who see him as quite relatable, with a backstory of sort of a strong former military, man who wants to come in and get the job done, who is sort of future face of the Liberal Party. You know, there's a big age gap between he and Susan Lee, for example. They know they need to engage with a younger voter base, and perhaps there's a thought that he can bring forward, you know, sort of this kind of fresh appeal of the Liberal Party. But at the same time, the way he's going about it isn't necessarily gathering him a huge support base amongst the moderates or the non-aligned within the party, even though there's this speculation in the papers today that people are switching allegiance to Andrew Hastie. I would be cautious about some of that rhetoric, because I think there's also the possibility that, yes, Andrew Hastie is put forward as an option, but in the end it's actually, you know, Angus Taylor, who we know is very keen on the leadership at some stage, who ends up actually having sort of more strength in numbers behind the scenes to actually make a pitch against Susan Lee at some point.
Mm. And they're blokes, and they look like prime ministers, and they wear suits and ties, and they, you know, they fit the bill. Whereas, you know, this is a woman. It's very, very difficult for these people. I do understand them trying, the difficulties they're having, getting their heads around the idea.
Yeah, I think that Susan Lee, in dealing with some of the questions that she's dealing with at the moment around, you know, she's got supporters of hers openly saying, like Maria Kovacic, that she's not being given the clear air to have a clean crack at this job. Frustrated members of her support base within the parliament who, you know, not just disappointed by where things have landed with the net zero debate, but more broadly with how she's being treated, like whether she's being treated with respect by her party. There's a genuine frustration there.
Yes.
And so, you know, when Susan Lee deals with those questions around whether she feels like she has been left hanging out to dry at times by other members of her party, she's always very positive. She always has a smile on her face, and she doesn't want to engage.
She's plucky, and you can see that in her interviews today, plucky. But what passes through their minds when they read the reports in today's press of the latest polling figures, which show One Nation at 18% and the Coalition at 24%. This is diabolical.
Well, what passes through some of their minds and is sometimes reiterated in conversations when, you know, you do chat to people about these numbers and how worried they are about them, some are panicking and thinking we need to swing harder and more into the right of the Australian political spectrum to make sure that those people don't feel left behind by that us and sort of move to One Nation. But then there's also others, particularly in the moderate wing of the Liberal Party, who are very keen to remind that there's no One Nation representatives in the lower house in the Australian Parliament, and that even if they do have quite strong numbers at the moment, we're nowhere near the next election, and that a lot can happen before then in terms of smoothing out any kind of early swings on support that might be really related to something like campaigning on migration. Because it's quite possible that a lot of people who might be feeling, oh, One Nation might be my party, might not be at all aware of the full nature of the One Nation policy platform. You know, Pauline Hanson is preparing to again introduce an attempt to ban burqas and face coverings in the Australian Parliament. They have some fairly unusual and controversial policies, even in the sort of tax and economics front. They are a party that might at the moment be associated in some people's minds with, you know, an anti-migration platform that resonates, but they have much broader set of platform policies that may well, if there's more coverage of them and more done to show what they stand for, might surprise the people who are, you know, being polled and identifying them as the party that resonates with their politics.
But don't you just leave One Nation to look after One Nation's, you know, tranche of voters and go off and win back the seats that you've lost in the prosperous suburbs of every city in the country? It just, I mean, I'm an amateur. I'm looking at this from the outside. But it does seem strange to leave behind your heartland, your old heartland, and pursue the fringes of One Nation policy. And now we know that immigration is coming up as the next battleground in the coalition.
But interestingly, on both fronts and on the question of whether or not the Liberal Party is you know, walking away from areas that at once, you know, held extremely dearly and unquestioningly were going to be handed back to the Liberal Party every election, there is this strong belief, rightly or wrongly, that the cost of power, the cost of energy, can be directly linked with net zero Labor's pitch on renewables, and that over time, as people are dealing with higher costs, that they will make that association and they will start to turn against Labor. That's the belief. And on the migration front as well, there is quite a lot of interest in the community, according to recent polling, in looking at whether or not Australia has to, you know, rein in some way or reduce migration.
Yes.
The sad thing is neither of the parties really has a long-term strategy for how it's going to handle migration. Labor doesn't have one either. It's actually been, you know, behind the times in terms of revealing some of its kind of key figures in sort of annual migration as well. So it's, I think, been described to me by some who watch this area really closely, is essentially a policy vacuum. So Labor does have a bit of blame here in terms of not being clear about what its migration policy is either, and trying to rein these figures in. So both parties have a bit to answer for around, you know, being credible on migration, I think.
Sure, but this is a possibility of taking us right back into the heart of race politics as we fight it in Australia, or have fought it since the time of John Howard. And it ain't,
it's tricky territory.
Ain't pretty.
It's tricky territory. And you think about the rallies in the streets, and you think about I think the Liberal Party is saying it's going to have principles that it will reveal before Christmas around what it might want to do with migration going forward, similar to the energy principles, I guess. But that doesn't mean that they're going to have any clear guardrails. They're not going to necessarily identify which stream of migration would be focused on. It sounds like international students may be carved out in some way, but, you know, that's also because the uni sector desperately needs that money. You look at backpackers, but that's sort of, you know, Nationals' heartland seats that require
fruit pickers,
workers to go out there. Then what are you left with? The skilled migration categories, and that's including the people who are building the houses, staffing the aged care homes, staffing the childcare centre. And then you're looking at the very small humanitarian intake. So that's unlikely to be, even if that is reduced, a significantly change the number of people coming into Australia. So it's very hard to see how they get there. And don't forget that Peter Dutton, when he went to the last election and said he was going to cut the 25% cut in migration he was talking about, he didn't actually put forward any policy for how he was going to get there. He said he'd do that if elected. So even in the last term of parliament, we didn't have a clear plan from the Liberal Party on migration. Even family reunion visas, which are a big issue in multicultural communities, be something that Susan Lee's looking at.
Yep. Look, in just a minute we have left, can you look to any victory that the opposition has had over the government this year, a win since the elections?
Well, they have worked with the crossbench on a couple of fronts. I think the most recent thing that comes to mind is the freedom of information laws that the government was trying to push through, which certainly raised a lot of controversy around whether or not the government was trying to crack down on transparency. That hasn't gone ahead. And when it comes to the environment protection laws, which we've spoken about in the past, at the moment there's no certainty that that'll get through before Christmas, because both the Greens and the Liberal Party have got concerns about that legislation. So there are areas where the Liberal Party has been able to use its numbers to ensure that things don't progress, and to make trouble for the government, and in some cases block things which they are fundamentally opposed to. But I think what's more important to note is that because there's been so much internal navel-gazing and disagreement within the coalition, quite likely there's a lot of things that the government is doing at the moment that just aren't rising to the surface and being reported as well as they would otherwise be.
Anna, thank you so much for joining us again on Late Night Live. Anna, where can people hear the podcast of your interview with Susan Lee?
Well, they can head to the SBS News website and it's posted there, and look forward to getting some feedback.
And compare and contrast with the interview with Susan Lee on 7:30. Anna, thanks so much for joining us once again on Late Night Live.
A pleasure. Thank you, David.
Coming up, the bloody civil war in Myanmar. A ceasefire in Myanmar after the massive earthquake early in the year didn't last long. By June, rebels and the military regime were back at war. The fighting is vicious. European countries are supporting the rebels, but China is providing air power to batter them. There's no end in sight to this civil war, but the regime has scheduled elections for late December, the first elections since they overthrew the government of Aung San Suu Kyi in 2021. Fiona McGregor is senior producer at Al Jazeera of a remarkable documentary, Myanmar, War with the Junta, that takes us behind the lines on both sides to shed new light on the state of the war and the country. Fiona joins me now from Thailand. Welcome to the show.
Hi, David. Thank you.
Fiona, just roughly, who has the upper hand at the moment, the regime or the rebels?
At the moment, the regime and the military have been taking back a lot of territory. So in that sense, they do seem to be on the ascendant in terms of their recent military successes. But, you know, we are still seeing the rebels, you know, having certain victories.
And how much territory do the rebels actually hold at the moment?
That's a little bit of a tricky one because, you know, things are going backwards and forwards and there's quite a lot of contested areas, but still a significant amount of the country.
How did you get the footage for that documentary? How did you get footage behind the regime's lines of what is being done there? It's extraordinary.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's most sort of notorious in a way about this conflict is how successful the military has been in stopping information getting out and shutting down internet. And, you know, so really very few people who are outside the country have had, you know, a chance to see what's going on inside. So that, you know, it's something that we very much focused on, and I think is a very, you know, important rare aspect of this documentary. Obviously, for security purposes, it would be a little bit difficult for me to share it with you. It would be risky for me to share exactly how things got out, how we got that information. But it did, you know, we have some very, very brave journalists in the country. There are, you know, soldiers like you have in conflicts across the world, you know, taking videos whilst they're you know, involved in action. But because it, you know, in Myanmar it's so difficult to get that footage out, that was the big challenge for us. So it's taken a lot of effort and bravery of different people to get that out and to be able to share it with the public.
And it seems to me that a lot of that footage is taken with a telephone. And I'm wondering whether the humble mobile phone is just changing the way in which wars can be reported, particularly wars where the regimes involved, and I'm thinking of Gaza as much as Myanmar, are determined that information not get out.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we see this, you know, as reporters, you can see, I think, in, as you say, Gaza in Ukraine, you know, evidence is being captured as it's happening. And I think, you know, I think it's hard to say how that's going to play out in international law and so on in future. But, you know, we're seeing, yeah, for the first time, almost live recordings of these incidents. So there's no kind of getting away from that. It's not people going back months or years later saying, you know, what happened. That evidence is there on people's phones, as you say.
The documentary has a rhythm of moving from sort of undercover footage to quite formal interviews in polished rooms of generals setting out their objectives. It goes back and forth between the two. It's a very interesting rhythm.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you point that out. I mean, I think that's in a way, in some ways, that's quite reflective of how war happens, doesn't it? You do have generals sitting in polished rooms making decisions. You do have, you know, some of the footage was or some of the interviews were done in kind of secretive locations because we had to be, because the people were, you know, that were speaking to us were taking great risks to do that. And then, of course, you have the frontline footage. So that's, you know, I'm really glad that's come across in the documentary, these many different aspects of how wars are fought and planned out and played out.
One of the principal themes of the documentary is the efforts being made by the regime to try to find more soldiers. What's happening there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a very important, a very key aspect in the documentary, and it's a very important part of what is going on in Myanmar just now. I mean, if you look at this time, you asked me at the start of the program who had the upper hand. If you asked that a year ago when we were, you know, doing early filming for this, it really looked like the rebels were on the ascendancy at that time. You know, since then the military have introduced and really brought into force this forced conscription policy, in which they are, as you see in the film, literally dragging people off the streets at times to fight on the front lines of their war. But the problem is that most of these people do not want to be there, and they're not trained soldiers. So they're relying on this, you know, this very weak, reluctant to fight soldiers to try and keep the momentum going. And it's very unclear how to do that for.
And there's also the fact that so many people are deserting from the regime's ranks. Who are the deserters?
Absolutely. I mean, you're seeing deserters at different levels. In the documentary, you'll see us speaking to people. We've got officers there. We've got you know, some quite senior people who were sort of forced to take part in things that they just found abhorrent. I think, you know, for a lot of people, seeing the violence, the brutalities done against ordinary civilians was too much, even for these sort of trained men who were, you know, born and raised to support the military. So you have those kind of deserters, but then you also have, as I was mentioning, these people that have been forced to fight, that, you know, literally are coming up against people from their own villages at times. And so when they get the excuse, you know, sorry, get the opportunity, they are, any excuse, they are fleeing to join the other side. So you've got that kind of the two elements, the ones that professional soldiers who are just so disgusted by what they've seen going on. And then you have the people that didn't want to fight in the first place. And I think that's a real, you know, weakness for the Myanmar military.
And a third category of police, an extraordinary number of police who have deserted.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And in a way that, you know, that makes sense, because although, you know, they're also part of the security forces, you know, they're very closely aligned with the military, you know, they're not all trained soldiers, you know, and they were being ordered, you know, to take part also in these brutalities against civilians. So yes, they're also turning their backs on the regime.
I don't know whether the standards is the right word, but I can't think of a better one for the moment. But by the standards of civil wars of this kind, of which we have seen many, is this particularly brutal? Is it just sort of routinely cruel?
I think all wars are brutal, but I think the consistent, you know, targeting of civilians that we're seeing here, and of their own people as well. You know, obviously Myanmar's got this long history of civil war, which traditionally really was carried out in the ethnic minority areas. And what we're seeing in this conflict is absolutely countrywide, and they are, you know, targeting civilians everywhere. So it's exceptionally brutal. I think I feel uncomfortable saying one war was more brutal than another, but it's certainly.
Yes, on reflection, I think I'm with you there. It is a grim thing to say, but it's exceptionally brutal even by the standards of civil wars. On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Fiona McGregor, who is a senior producer of Myanmar Exposed, a series of reports by Al Jazeera Investigative Unit, and of their most recent documentary, Myanmar, War with the Junta. Fiona, the rebels, who are they? To what extent do they represent the government overthrown by the military in 2021?
Okay, so as I just mentioned earlier, the fighting is happening across the country. There were already in Myanmar very established ethnic armies who have a long history of fighting against the Myanmar military for degrees of autonomy, and who are very well trained and very experienced. After the coup, what we also saw were in, you know, central Myanmar, these areas that didn't have a long tradition of civil war, what are called People's Defence Forces springing up. And they, many of them went and got training with these ethnic armed groups. So you have this kind of coalition of these established armies and these newer People's Defence Forces fighting together and forming coalitions, you know, to take on the military. And, you know, that's, I think that's been one of the reasons that the military struggled so much. It's never had fighting on so many fronts at the same time. So it's been extremely stretched on that front.
And the former government of Aung San Suu Kyi survives as a government in exile?
Well, the NLD, her party, was disbanded and by the military, and she was imprisoned along with her her president. The NUG, the National Unity Government, sort of has been working, you know, from exile to try and act as a government in exile, but it certainly doesn't have kind of international recognition in the same way that the military has managed to hold on to, despite, you know, a lot of objections to how it's operating.
Now, it's promised elections. What's the view of these elections? Does anybody have much confidence that they'll actually represent the feelings of the country?
Within Myanmar, no. And I think internationally, certainly, Europe, even within ASEAN, there's, you know, no serious belief that these could possibly represent the will of the people of Myanmar. There is some support for the elections from China and I think Russia. You know, Myanmar military's international political allegiance is there, but in terms of people, you know, watching it as a supposed democratic process, no, I don't think there's any confidence there at all.
I note that the United Nations, Human Rights Watch and Western governments have condemned the whole thing as a sham. But why does the junta want to hold this this sham?
As if it can, you know, it promised after the coup that it would hold elections relatively quickly. It hasn't been able to do that because of the ongoing fighting. It's taking this opportunity to try and hold elections in as much of the country as it can do, although it's absolutely not managing to do that. And Minung Lang, the senior general, he's acknowledged that they won't be able to hold elections countrywide. Also, you know, they're not allowing key opposition parties to stand. So it does seem very much kind of window dressing from their perspective.
And they think it's worthwhile, even though all of those international agencies and a number of countries have already condemned the whole process as a sham. Even so, it's worth them doing.
They seem to think so, yes. As I said, it's hard to see that it would be more than window dressing. It might allow China, for example, to say, right, we can see there's been a clear transition at this point, and there's now what they might recognise as a legitimate government in force.
But as I understand it, to even criticise the process of the election is a crime.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that law was just brought in July, and there's already been 100 people or more, I think, arrested and charged under this law. So even, you know, for liking Facebook posts on social media that might have been critical of the upcoming elections, people are being arrested for that. And, you know, I think I was hearing that even people who have been displaced by the war are coming under pressure from the military, saying, right, you have to turn out and vote for us. So, yeah, there's huge amount of pressure.
How many people have been displaced by the fighting?
I think it's something like 3 million people. It's huge.
Fiona, you've lived in Myanmar for a number of years.
Yeah.
You make documentaries about it. You know it very well. You know the state of the fighting intimately. What do you think is going to happen in that country? Where's it heading?
I think one thing that people that have spent a lot of time looking at Myanmar know is that making firm predictions is not wise. I think what I can say is it's unlikely that we're going to see any form of sustained peace for the foreseeable future, that this war is going to run on and on. And even if the military are, as we're seeing at the moment, gaining, you know, some ground again, there are other parts of the country. We see in Rakhine State in particular, where they really don't have any control at all, apart from a couple of very small areas. They have never managed to control the whole country. You know, there's always been civil wars of some sort going on. And I think that's going to carry on. And it's, you know, it's a very hard thing to say when you're seeing people, you know, fighting. It's not, you know, who believe in this cause that they are fighting for, and they don't want to be written off. And I'm not writing people off, but I just don't see that. I don't think we will see peace in the foreseeable future.
Fiona, thank you for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you, David.
I've been speaking to Fiona McGregor, senior producer with Al Jazeera's investigative unit, about their new documentary, Myanmar, War with the Junta, that can be seen now on Al Jazeera's YouTube channel. Coming up, collisions in space. There's a lot of room up there, but space is filling up with junk. Old satellites, bits of rockets, random debris of all kinds. One estimate suggests there are about 1 million pieces of junk from the size of a pea to a clenched fist in space now. Academics study waste in space these days, and last week they held a conference in Canberra under the title Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management. One of the keynote speakers was Professor Aaron Rosengren from the Department of Mechanical and Aerospace Engineering at the University of California, San Diego. And he joins me in the studio now. Aaron, welcome.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
So space is filling up with junk.
Yeah, I mean, we've been tracking objects since Sputnik, and you know, the growth rate of satellites and launches, even up into the 90s, has been pretty linear. It's only in more recent times that we're seeing an exponential growth of objects in orbit. And this doesn't just include our satellites that we rely on for communication, navigation, weather, everything that really makes our modern world what it is. But we also have now a serious issue with space debris, which comes from anything from fragmentation events, so a satellite just exploding in space, to collisions. And we've had at least one collision between two intact satellites. That was Iridium Cosmos, and that occurred in 2009. We also have had
two satellites just bashing into each other.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic as well, because at the time, space traffic management wasn't really a term adopted yet. We did monitor, at the time it was NORAD, and it became the Space Command, but it's now the 18th Space Defense Squadron monitors all the objects, provides conjunction data messages, which tells the operators, hey, you need to maybe maneuver. There's a chance a 1 in 1,000 would be a threshold, or 1 in 10,000. You need to maneuver your spacecraft, or else a collision could occur. At that time, Iridium was active. It was part of a constellation. And Cosmos was a defunct former Russian military satellite.
So it was a dead one hitting a live one.
Well, it was more the live one hitting the dead one, because Iridium actually maneuvered that day doing their normal orbital maintenance maneuver to get it into the zone that it needed to be in. And it actually maneuvered into that collision. But at the time, prior to this Iridium Cosmos conjunction, there was not a report that it was at danger. And this is an issue. So they didn't think that there was any risk. And of course they maneuvered, and then that new computed risk was not fed to them in time, and they collided with a defunct debris. And some of that debris is at altitudes of at the time, it was the most contested, congested region of low Earth orbit, which was that 8,000 or 800 kilometer altitude regime where we have our sun sink orbits and a lot of other things. But these debris will last for tens to hundreds of years in orbit.
Okay, now let's get some terms right. Low Earth orbit.
Yeah, so for a long time, we've used these altitude classifications of circumterrestrial space, so things that orbit the Earth. Low Earth orbit is the altitudes from the 200 kilometers, so basically the altitude at which you can orbit at least once before you re-enter on account of atmospheric drag, all the way up to the tenuous regions of the atmosphere, so up to 2,000 kilometers altitude. It's called LEO, low Earth orbit, and as you go beyond that, you have medium Earth orbit, which is a terrible name to describe everything between low Earth orbit, again, at 2,000 kilometers altitude, up into the geosynchronous region, which is about 7 Earth radii from the center of the Earth. So it's 42,000 kilometers from the Earth. And that's geosynchronous because the orbital periods are commensurate. They're the same orbital period as the Earth's rotation period. So the things will stay put. So that's kind of what you can think of as our our national space, right? Our airspace. It's something above a country, but of course it's only in the equator. And so we have geosynchronous, we have LEO. So we call that GEO. We have
and
LEO.
Just on LEO for a minute, low Earth orbit. That's where all the commercial satellites are?
Not necessarily. We also have a lot of things in GEO and geosynchronous orbit.
And all of these have junk in them?
Every regime has debris, yeah. We're also even finding things that were launched in the Apollo era. Even though they've escaped the Earth-Moon system, they've went into heliocentric space. Some of those are returning.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, and I'm talking to Aaron Rosengren about junk in space. And his voice, ladies and gentlemen, is the voice of a man who has been speaking at a number of conferences in Australia, most recently in Canberra, Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management. Now, Aaron, junk can be tracked?
Well, certain junk can be tracked, right? You know, the catalog that you can download publicly on SpaceTrack, this is managed by the 18th, there's about 26,000 trackable objects. Those are about the size of your cell phone in LEO, up to about a meter in GEO. We track those from ground-based capabilities like optical telescopes and radar. We track about 26,000 pieces of object that could cause a catastrophic failure to a spacecraft if a collision were to occur. There's also about a million, as you said in the beginning, a million pieces of objects that are predicted. Now, these are predicted based on what's called debris evolutionary models by NASA. ESA and all the other space agencies have various modeling capabilities that project kind of like a forecast of what the debris population will be like and what it is because of fragmentation events that have already occurred of objects that we just can't see. But we're imagining that there's probably about 500,000 objects that can cause a disruption to our satellite services that we simply can't see at the present time.
Okay, and none of this can be cleaned up. You can't send an immense vacuum into space and clean up the junk. Your eyes say otherwise, Aaron.
No, so the focus largely has been on mitigation. How do we stop polluting what is already there? And you know, in LEO, things will come down naturally. Of course, the lifetimes depends critically on the altitudes. And so some things can stay in orbit for hundreds of years. But we now think about ways in which we can leverage the natural dynamics to maybe mitigate the potential for collisions, right? How does Starlink orbit so many satellites in such a narrow band of space and not have to worry about collisions? It's not because they're doing their autonomous collision avoidance. It's because they've designed those orbits in a very meticulous way, leveraging astrodynamical theory from, you know, the early age of the space age. So all these theoretical foundations are finally finding a way to help with space sustainability efforts.
So junk can be mapped and tracked. And people sending satellites into space, rockets into space, can actually track their way through or past or around the obstacles that are floating out up there.
Yeah, and this is done, of course, as we start to launch more and more mega constellations. Amazon Kuiper is going to go online here pretty soon. we're going to have a big debris and active satellite field in which to navigate through. Now, space is quite big, right? We know from the Hitchhiker's Guide, and that's true. So it's not like what you see in Star Wars in the asteroid belt, right? It's even in the asteroid belt, you can't go from one asteroid and even see the other one with an optical system. So things are very spread out. But of course, the issue is that they travel at really large speeds, and of course, they're not coming back. So think of air traffic control, where at least they land and then take off. Things in orbit will, you know, from low Earth orbit, will orbit about 15 times a day up to GEO, which is one orbital period per day. And then when you get to beyond GEO, which is the area that I study quite extensively, you have these long dwell orbits, multi-day periods. They're hard to track because they're very far out. So the low signal to noise ratio, they're very dim. So that's going to be an issue too, is how to track things that you can't really see.
Sounds like somewhere that needs rules. And that might have been hard enough when space was a matter of governments, but space is now a private enterprise. How do you tell Elon Musk to obey the rules of dealing with his own junk?
Yeah, it's a bit of a tragedy of the space commons. Well, industry managed to regulate by themselves the geobelt, because the geobelt is a critical resource. Things that are slotted in GEO, at the end of their life, they move them to a graveyard, not because they're good stewards of space, but that's because they want that slot for their other capability.
That's where they make their money.
That's where they make their money. And they have all operators have an interest in protecting GEO, because one collision in space doesn't just pollute that regime. It actually goes and can permeate all of the orbital zones. And in fact, when you get even beyond GEO, objects that collide or objects that fragment, that's going to be a huge prediction issue. We don't know where those objects can go.
Explain to us all why there has been this extraordinary leap in the number of satellites or whatever going into space. Up till about 2015, the graphs looked pretty level, nothing much, no very dramatic change. But suddenly in 2015, the line is vertical. Why?
Yeah, it's a direct reflection of the cost of launch. It has dramatically decreased. And as a result, like SpaceX, it's changed the cost to get into orbit. And so you now have also smaller components, smaller satellites that are able to do incredible things. We're launching, maybe not the same megalithic satellites that we're doing before, but we're now looking at a collection of satellites to do some kind of application, not just constellations, but satellites flying in formation to maybe do observations of exoplanets, like having a distribution of satellites in formation. So not just that the cost have gone down, but we've seen application now in terms of components and the smaller sort of electronics.
How big are satellites these days?
Depends.
Depends, of course. How small can they be and how big can they be?
So we have something launched by Advanced Space, and this is a CubeSat. I think it's a 3U CubeSat. So it's about the size of a fridge, mini fridge. Then you have things like Integral, which is a megalithic, 2-ton bus that's just beyond GEO. That's going to come down in 2029. So we have things that range in scale, and also it depends on the cross-sectional area, what you're talking about. So if you have a big solar sail attached to your spacecraft, that presents a bigger cross-sectional area for a potential conjunction.
Right. Oh, conjunction. What a beautiful word. Not collision.
Yeah, we don't use collision.
Conjunction.
Conjunction, yeah.
Wow. Hey, design for demise. What's that? I'm going to go through some of the language now, Design for demise.
Let's go through some of the astrodynamical parlance. So that is the idea that as we re-enter, a spacecraft will fragment, will completely ablate in the atmosphere, leaving no trace of it on ground. Now that is a notion that the European nation, ESA, they wanna advocate for, because in this case we don't have any risk of casualty on ground.
What about cone of shame? This sounds really interesting.
Yeah, so the cone of shame was the moniker given by, I think, AFRL, Air Force Research Laboratory, and then the Space Force to indicate the region that is in front of the moon and also behind the moon. So it's a conal region from the Earth extending to the moon. Now, the cone of shame is called that because if you're trying to look at objects orbiting there, you have a bright moon behind you. So if you only have optics, you have the issue with signal-to-noise ratio, right? You're not supposed to look at the sun, right? We don't do daytime observations for a reason. So this is the issue with the cone of shame, is that the thought is that if objects are dwelling near the Lagrange points or even at the moon or behind the moon at the other Lagrange point, then we're not going to be able to see them. So it's a shame.
It's interesting. Aaron, it's interesting. It's not quite as interesting as I thought it might be with a name like that.
Yeah.
But look, tell me very, very seriously, are there weapons in space?
Well, space is space. According to the Outer Space Treaty, is not supposed to be a domain for weapons. As to whether they exist, I don't even have a clearance to tell you that. certainly, it's a military domain. We use assets in space. If you go download the public catalog, now there's a number of objects that are not listed in that we do track. Now those are military reconnaissance satellites, and so you could think of those as being a form of weapon in space. And these are things that provide communication and regimes. And of course, we see with the Ukraine-Russia conflict, we see where certain commercial entities can even be involved in these conflicts. So,
well, if a satellite can tell me which side of the street my car is parked on, as it can, then no doubt it's very useful in the Russia-Ukraine conflict. Aaron, can you reassure us that we are not going to be killed by falling space debris anytime soon, wandering around? And can you reassure us that Mr. Musk's rockets aren't going to be torn to shreds by shrapnel hanging about in the zones above the Earth? Is this a future danger we're talking about here, or a present danger?
It's a future danger that if we don't take it seriously in the present time, we could end up doing long-term damage to our ability to operate in space. And not just that, I think the cost of getting into space is going to increase if you have to insure your satellites. Satellite insurance, that, you know, you might not know this, is an actual
thing. I've never
thought
of that. There is satellite insurance.
There's satellite insurance. The cost of operating in space could go up if we don't take it more seriously in the present time. And there's a lot of initiatives, and I think Australia has also a unique geographical vantage in order to assist the global efforts in this domain. And of course, that the conference that I went to in Canberra, that's I believe the fifth iteration of that, but that has gone back many, many years, decades before, to other efforts that have been done in this region.
Aaron, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Really great to be here. Thank you.
I've been talking to Professor Aaron Rosengren, who has just given the keynote address at the Australian Space Domain Awareness and Space Traffic Management Conference in Canberra. And Aaron is a professor of aerospace engineering at the University of California, San Diego. This is Late Night Live. And that's the show. On our next, a conversation with Helen Garner, whose books are taking off in the United States, who's collected diaries, has just won the Bailey Gifford Prize, a big deal in Britain, and who has, with Chloe Hooper and Susan Krasnostein, just published The Mushroom Tapes, their account of the trial of Erin Patterson, who served beef Wellington to her husband's family with lethal consequences. There is a lot to talk about.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.